Today is the 7th of February, 2012. Today is a very auspicious day. Today is the full moon. And the moon is in Cancer in the sky. And Venus has just moved into Pisces. So all the feminine elements are at their zenith right now. They're as strong can be. Moon and Venus are the two feminine planets. So when the moon is strong and Venus is strong, then that's the time for the feminine to take some predominance, to gain the upper hand. And we all know that we need a mega dose of the feminine in our world, don't we? Because the male energy has run amok, it appears. Just no stopping those boys. And that male ego begins to run amok. So we can focus today on the pacifying energy of the full moon. I know it's full moon sometimes pushes people over the edge, but still, it's when the moon is full, it means the heart is open. And if the heart is open, it can be more receptive. In our world, it seems, well, this has been my experience from doing Vedic astrology charts for 35 years. Many, many people are capable of giving. But not many people are capable of receiving. It's not easy to receive. You'd think that would be the easiest thing. Oh, well, just here, let me have what you have to offer. But yet most of us go through life not having our emotional needs met for one reason or another. And once the trust is breached in childhood or whenever, oh, what to speak of once, twice, three times, and then we begin to shut down. We begin to close ourselves, withdraw, protect. Once that happens, it's very difficult to reopen that because we feel we can't trust. And you can't get your needs met if you won't open up, if you don't trust, if you cannot trust. And in order to receive, you must become vulnerable. But not vulnerable in a foolish way. Vulnerable using discretion. You must be able to open up and be vulnerable and receive. So, anyway, you can think about that. This is a day in which all of this would be very, very possible. Because the moon is in Cancer. Cancer is arguably the most nurturing position for the moon. Moon is mother. Moon is the nurturer and the mother and the who gives love, nurturing love, motherly love. And moon in Cancer, people who have moon in Cancer in their birth chart, if they're female, they are the best mothers walking the planet. Second to none. They are born to be mothers. I find that moon in Cancer is even a better mothering instinct than moon in Taurus. Moon is exalted in Taurus, but the mothering instinct is much stronger in Cancer. I've seen many people with moon in Cancer who may not be mothers and not have children, but they take in every stray animal they find out in the road and bring him into the house. I've seen many like this. Even the ones full of fleas, I've seen. Not always the best idea. And now Venus has moved into into Pisces. I don't have my thing in front of me right now. About a month. Just moved in a couple of days ago. So Venus is the planet of love, creativity, joy, charity, benevolence, kindness, sympathy, empathy, unconditional love, universal love, love beyond borders and designations, all the way up to love of God, depending what level you're operating on. Some people just want to love, one love. Some people want the family. Some people want the community. Some people want the nation. Some people want the EU, European Union. Some don't. Depends what you, how you're oriented, but to go all the way up is the best. So Venus being in Pisces is an excellent time to deepen your love or express your love or allow yourself to be loved. That's the harder thing. Allowing yourself to be loved. Anyway, it's a very auspicious day today. And I noticed that, interestingly, no men showed up. Yeah. Now, there were men that had said they were coming. And they didn't come. It's all ladies and me. So I'll represent the male side of the spectrum here. Anyway. Okay, so I thought we'd do a few things today. I thought we'd begin with just one verse from the Bhagavad Gita. And then from there, I want to tell you a couple of stories. I'm sort of going to tell them to you and read them to you as we go. There are stories I'm familiar with, but there's some bits and pieces that I have not committed to memory, and I don't want to miss them, so I'll sort of read them and speak them to you at the same time. So to begin with, let's look at the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is the conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. Krishna was on the planet 5,000 years ago. Krishna is God. He is an avatar. He came down. Avatar means he descends. He comes down. Avatar is a word that's bandied about quite frequently these days in many different circles. This is actually an avatar. So anyway, in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, text 5, this is Sanskrit. This is actual Sanskrit. We were talking earlier, the girls were showing me a mantra that was meant to be Sanskrit, but it was an Arabic one. This is a Sanskrit one. Nirmana moha jitta sanga, nirmana moha jitta sanga dosha adhyatma nitya vinivritta kama dvandvair vimukta sukha dukkha sangyair gachantya mudha padam avyayam tat. So this says, one who is free from illusion, false prestige, and false association, who understands the eternal, who is finished with material desire, and is freed from the duality of happiness and distress, and who knows how to surrender unto the Supreme Person, attains to that eternal kingdom. So one who's free from illusion, false prestige, and false association. So what's the number one illusion?
That we think we're this body.
That you think you're this body. That's the number one illusion. If you drive a BMW, are you a BMW? No. You own a car that is a BMW, and you put yourself inside the car, and you drive the BMW. Just like you have somehow put yourself inside this body, and you, the soul, are driving it around in various ways. So the number one illusion is to think you're that body and to identify with all the things that come with the body. I'm this gender. I'm a female. I'm born in Ireland. I went to such and such a school. These are my parents. This is what I do for a living. Is that true? Yeah. But which lifetime are we talking about? The current one? Okay. What'd you do last life? And the one before that? And the one before that? And the one before that? What about the one where you were a meadowlark? Do you remember that one?
What?
A meadowlark.
Bird.
Oh, it's a bird.
A meadowlark.
A meadowlark. What about the one when you were an owl? Do you remember that one? Janice phoned memories of that one. Okay, so one who's free from illusion, false prestige. What causes false prestige? Ego. So we can have negative ego and positive ego, or let's say it this way, deflated ego and inflated ego. Which one do we want? Neither. Both are bad. Why? What does the deflated ego do? Poor me. Oh, this happened to me. And then that happened to me. And then he did that to me. And she said that to me. And then I got laid off. And then this happened. And I got a flat tire. Now, maybe you did. But we can't slip into the deflated ego. If we do, what happens? We identify with it. And that becomes our reality. And we manifest it over and over again. Do we not? That's the problem. And what's the inflated ego do? Mock over everybody. I'm better than absolutely everybody. But no one knows that yet, just me. That's the inflated ego. Right? And an inflated ego will sooner or later burst. So somebody will prick it with a pin and then it'll burst. Hopefully. So, false prestige or any kind of identification. Let's go back to the car analogy. Can you drive a BMW? Is there something wrong with driving a BMW? No. It's a well-made car. It's a very good car. What would be wrong with driving a BMW, if anything? According to false prestige. Yes, if you thought you were better than others, if you became identified with the car is me. I'm driving a BMW and you're driving a Nissan Micra. And I saw in the news that the guy who drives a Nissan Micra owes 132,000 euros in toll fees that he didn't pay. Now, talk about false prestige. Who's got false prestige? The Nissan Micra guy. He thinks he doesn't have to pay the toll. So, we're clear on false prestige. False association. What does it mean, false association? Or negative association? Is it okay to hang out with anybody? Why not? Maybe you have false prestige.
Mm-hmm. We even said
discretion, though.
That's discretion. You have to exercise discretion. So what is false association? What is negative association? It causes what? What will happen to you? It will bring you down to that level. You can spend as much time. You can spend as much time as you want. Yeah. Supposing two people come together. One has a higher level of consciousness. The other one has a lower level of consciousness. If the one who has a higher level of consciousness is able to benefit the one with the lower level of consciousness and raise them up even a little, then that is a useful, worthy exchange. Correct? Mm-hmm. But if the one with the lower level of consciousness infects or affects the one with a higher level and pulls that person down, why don't we just go and do such and such? Oh, I don't do that anymore. Oh, yeah, well, you should try it again because it's really good. And you pull that one down. So, that's why. That's negative. If it has a negative effect on you, and you wake up the next morning, you go, oh my God, what have I done? That is negative association. Right. Okay. Very easy to figure these out in practical examples. Okay. Who understands the eternal? Why is that important? What do I care about the eternal? I'm here, it's now. Be here now. Why don't I care about the eternal? So why is the eternal important?
To get you out of your ego.
Yeah. But, I mean, the ego is what I'm enjoying with now. It's my ego that's helping me enjoy. So what do I care about the eternal?
Because you have to be responsible for actions in that.
Yeah, correct. And this comes to an end. If we put all our energy in our identification with this world is temporary. And it comes to an end. Who do you know historically who doesn't die? Name me one person you've ever heard of that skipped death. Yeah, fair enough. That's it. So the eternal means goes on and on and on and on. We accept the soul to be eternal. The soul does not die. When the body dies, wears out, gets old, whatever, the soul leaves the body and goes on, right? So the eternal is important because if we identify with the eternal, then our identification is correct and true. We'll go beyond this one lifetime. And we'll go beyond the limitation of this. And when death comes, what is the number one fear of every being, animals, birds, humans, insects, what is the number one fear?
Death.
What is the fight or flight mechanism? What is that about? Isn't that to danger, which could end up in death? With animals, with us, it's not so much a life and death, because we live in a so-called civilized society. But animals could be gone in an instant. You know, they can get swallowed up very quickly. So, death, you know, that's the fear. So, that's why you know death is coming. I've told you this before in the Mahabharata. Yamaraj, who is the god of death, who handles the business of death. And he disguises himself and he appears in front of Yudhishthira, who is a saintly king. And he starts asking him questions. They're sort of like riddles, but they're just questions. He says, tell me the most amazing thing in the world of humans. what is the single most amazing thing? And Yudhishthira says, oh, that all humans see everybody around them dying, but they never for 1 minute think it'll happen to them. It'll happen to everybody, but not me. He says, correct. That is the single most amazing thing. Okay, so the eternal. One who is done with material desire. Now, if I watch TV, if I watch the telly, and they bombard me with commercials, and they do, and they are trying to get me to buy everything from A to Z and sign up and sign on for everything else, because if I get these things, I'll be happy. I'll get the girl. I'll be happy. I'll get money. I'll get good insurance coverage at a low rate. I'll get all kinds of things that will make me happy, right? That's how they sell it. And is it true? Will I be happy? So if I follow material desire, there must be some happiness in the fulfillment of material desire.
But short-lived, because it's attached to material things.
Right. And what comes from that? Action and reaction. So you have to, at some point, pay the piper. And if you generate karma, positive or negative, you have to do what?
Come back again.
You have to come back again and experience the positive reaction to your good deeds and the negative reaction to your negative deeds. You are guaranteed another birth. If at the point of death you have one single material desire, what does material desire mean? Connected to? Your BMW, your material energy, your body, matter. One single desire, you'll come back so that you can fulfill that desire. Is that a curse? No, that's a blessing. You're the one who has the desire. You need a vehicle. That's what this whole ghost thing is. Wandering ghosts, or the Buddhists call them hungry ghosts. They got no body. You can't enjoy yourself, you can't fulfill desires in the material realm with no body. You need a body. And that's why some of these, you know, dark ghosts try to jump in your body, take over. But we won't get into that tonight. So we should try as much as possible to not overindulge our material desires, limit our material desires, and reduce them in time. And what? Have no desire? Walk around with no desire? Not possible. Not really possible. There is desire. Souls have desire. So we shift it from the material focus to the spiritual focus. And it's a question of being reoriented. That takes practice, as we know.
But the ultimate goal is cessation of desire as well. Like moksha is cessation of desire.
Moksha is cessation of desire.
So.
But love of God is higher than moksha.
Okay, but I'm just trying to make a distinction. Is it the same as in
moksha? Is cessation of material desire, and if you look at the, there's two philosophies or two approaches in Indian philosophy or Eastern philosophy, Vedic philosophy, yoga philosophy. One is personal, one is impersonal. So the impersonalists who say God is simply energy will say you want to become free from all desire and merge into the energy of Brahman. Brahman is spirit. You're a spirit and you merge into spirit. And in that, experience, you lose your identity. All right? That's moksha or mukti. But in the personal concept, which is the one we adhere to here, one goes into relationship with God, in a loving, reciprocal relationship with God. And there's no need to lose desires, and there's no loss of identity. You have, now you may not be Shifra, as you are today, but you will still have an eternal identity, and within the scope of that, you can have an eternal relationship. Well, your relationship with God eternally can go on now. We don't have to wait till later. But
so there isn't renunciation in that sense.
Renunciation is the renunciation of anything that is does not serve your higher loving relationship with God. So that is what the renunciation is. So we renounce that which is material, but we embrace that which is spiritual. So it's not a path of nivritti, of complete renunciation. It's a path of pravritti, accepting that which is favorable to your spiritual development and your relationship to God. We don't reject that which is unfavorable. Is there something wrong with owning a car? No. Depends what you use it for. Is there something wrong with having a house? No. Is there something wrong with being a multimillionaire? No. It depends what you use it for. Is there something wrong with being poor if you choose to be poor and you don't want to have money? No. Depends. It all depends on your point of view and your attitude. I mean, for centuries, monks, nuns, and renunciates have taken very austere vows of poverty, chastity, obedience, celibacy, many different kinds of vows. Something wrong with that? No. Is it for everybody? Clearly, no. It's for some. And if it enhances your spiritual experience and your communion with God, perfect. But if it doesn't, you know, if you're walking around pretending you're spiritual, but you're getting up to some hanky-panky when you change out of your spiritual clothes and put on your regular clothes, and you're up to some mischief, better be careful. Of course, that hasn't happened very often, has it? Okay. Freed from the duality of happiness and distress. Or attraction and repulsion. Right? Attraction and repulsion. This is good, that's bad. That's what you say. The next person says, this is good, and that's bad. So which is it? Stay in the middle. Don't be attached to either. Somebody sent me some jokes, you know, on the internet. Friends send you these jokes on Obama. They're really funny, you know. So I sent them off just to a handful of people. I never send it off to my mega mailing list. Just a handful of people I send off these jokes. Well, my God. You know, some people have no sense of humor. Well, obviously I sent them to Democrats. And they did not think they were funny. Oh, you hate Obama that much, do you? I know, I don't really hate Obama, but I thought they were funny. I was saying to Kalindi last night, I said, that's it, I'm not sending jokes anymore. Because it's not worth it for what came back, you know. They were hilarious. Anyway, I'm not sending any more jokes. So, happiness and distress. We are to remain unattached. This, for me, honestly, is the absolute hardest thing. The hardest thing. When I see people who are very, very cruel and they mistreat others, you know, I am pro death penalty. Shoot them now. Sort them out. I'm all for it.
Yes.
Oh, I'm totally. Get rid of them. Don't let them hurt anybody else. That's how I feel. And then people who just do, you know, things that aren't very clever and cause a lot of problems. Things like that. So it's hard to learn to be detached and to be unaffected. This is my point. You know, I'm sure we all have our little areas where, you know, you have your pet peeve. So I just revealed one or two of mine. Not always easy. And one who knows how to surrender unto the Supreme Person. What is this term? Surrender. When you hear the term surrender, does that make you happy, excited? And do you run toward that? Or do you go, oh, hang on a second. Surrender to what? To whom? What does it make you feel? What's your immediate take on that? When somebody asks you, just surrender. Pardon?
That you won't have any control.
That you won't have any control. Exactly. So we are all busy. We're all mini controllers, mini me's, walking across the earth. What are we as individuals trying to control in our lives? Pretty much everything. Tell me what you've given up control of. Please tell me. We try to control everything. If we can. Some of us are a little more casual than others. Some of us don't pull strings. Some of us really pull strings. And squeeze tightly. Some of us are a little more, you know, go with the flow. But that's why we're here. We're all here because we're all mini controllers, mini me's. And surrender means to give up all control. Scary business. Now, then you might say reasonably, well, wait a second. Who am I giving my control to? To whom am I surrendering? Well, then we say the answer is to the Supreme Person, to God. And then one must become informed of what that means exactly. And one must develop a relationship with God, come to know. If you don't like the term God, then use the term you like. Because the only joy is complete surrender. That is the highest form of bliss. Where you don't have to control anything. You just surrender completely. Why? Doesn't sound like it'd be fun. Because it is the natural constitutional position of each and every soul. Because we are part and parcel of God. So, that's why. And that's the highest experience that we can have. So one who can do the things as mentioned can attain the eternal kingdom. Or, well, they translate it here as kingdom, but it is the padam avyayam. Padam is a place, a position, a location. Padam also means the feet. But it's a state. And the avyayam means indestructible, never ends, never dies, eternal. Padam avyayam. That's what you can attain when you can do all these things that, as mentioned. Doesn't sound too bad. It takes a few thousand lifetimes to kind of work out the kinks, get it to where it needs to be. Questions, comments? Anybody real close? This close? Padam avyayam. Glend. Lindy, she has wonderful, wonderful spiritual experiences. I can't tell them now. She's close to the Padma Vyayam. Now, I thought we would talk a little bit about the deity form of God. You guys don't say deity here, you say? Deity. In Sanskrit, it is Murti. Murti is form. On the mantle, you'll see deity forms. On the left is Lakshmi. In the center is Radha. Oh no, don't do that. Thank you. In the middle is Krishna and Radha. And then to the right is Narayan or Vishnu and Lakshmi. That is Lakshmi there and Lakshmi there. It's Lakshmi is the divine feminine. So she can take different forms. And then way over on the other side is Ganesh. But these are actually those two there, that Vishnu and Lakshmi on the far end. Those are carved in white marble. Those are proper deity forms. These ones over in the left are porcelain. So they're not, I mean, they can be deity forms, but when in India, you don't get porcelain deities so much. You get marble or wood or a metal. But those ones on the right, the white marble of Vishnu and Lakshmi, those are proper deity forms. Okay? So, statues. In Christianity, we call them statues. But it's different. It's not... A statue means a likeness or an image of a saint or of Jesus or whomever, right? But that's... This is not a statue, because the concept of a deity means that inside the deity is the deva or the devi, the god or the goddess.
And the effort that goes into bringing them.
Yes. God has explained in the Vedas, in the books, yoga books, that God in his male and female forms, that he will happily enter into material forms made out of marble or wood or metal, whatever. Some stone takes also in stone forms. So he says he'll take those forms, he will enter into the forms with his energy, with his spirit. Why? So this is different than a statue, because once God's energy is in, it's God. You say, well, no, it's not God, it's marble. No, it's God. Why does this happen? Why is this necessary? Because you can't see God. That's why. Well, why can't I see God? Because you're not qualified to see God. You haven't qualified yourself enough through making yourself a suitable vehicle, pure enough, and raising your vibration up to a point where you can see God. Can you do this? Yes. Should you do this? Well, we hope so. We want you to. But until you do, you can meditate on God in an energetic form, but it's very difficult. It's hard to focus on an energy. You know from your life here on earth, when you focus on your loved ones, what do you see first in your mind? You see their form. You see their face. Right? Or your dog, or your cat, or your horse, or whatever it might be. Or your friend. You see them. You think about the things they did, and you laugh, and this is what happened, you know, things you've done together, and this is how it works. This is how we have relationships. So it's much easier to focus on God when there's an image, a form, than if it's just some, you know, inscrutable energy floating around out there. Good luck with that one. It's not that easy. You say, well, this is divine energy. Yeah, okay. And next thing you know, geez, I'm hungry. I'd like to eat something. What happened to the divine energy? So that's why these forms are there. So you can then, once God enters in, or you regard God in those forms, you can render service to God. Look at how nicely Clindy has rendered service by taking the money that Catherine has given, going out, buying the flowers, and doing this wonderful flower arrangement. And then Maduri has brought these flowers. Eilish has brought these flowers. This is all for God's pleasure. You see? So that's service. And you get spiritual benefit from that. So how do we get God to go into these forms? There are special rituals, prayers, mantras, and invocations, and that have been in Vedic literatures for thousands of years to tell you how to bring God down and have him enter. Does it work? Oh yeah. It works. So that's what I was.
Once it happens,
go ahead. Yeah, this is the thing.
You don't do it to normal little ones like this because.
Well, you can. You can, honestly.
If you're going to be around, it's always too now.
Well, there's a standard.
There's no going on holidays.
There's a standard. If you invoke Radha Krishna energy or Vishnu and Lakshmi energy, which is very, very the highest level, if you invoke those, we have not invoked those energies into these forms. Because if we had, they would have to be served all day long, every day, like a person. You couldn't like, oh, now they're just statues. I'm going away for 2 weeks. We're going on holiday, so see ya. You can't do that. You can't do that. You have to treat them like... Yeah. 6 times a day. You make offerings and they do pujas and, you know... Yeah, that's right. They do the whole thing. So once you do that, you have to do that. Okay. Now, there are some that you can do a minimal service. Not so much.
What happens if you don't?
Then you're making an offense. It's like if you invite the queen over, because the queen came over, for example, and then you put her up in a hotel and you just ignore her. It's like that. What happens is...
She'll go back.
Nothing necessarily will happen to you, but you're inviting an important personality and then you're ignoring them. Hmm. It's like that.
But if you invoke a deity by saying a prayer or a mantra and then you forget to do it one day, that's
a different thing. You invoke the deity simply by chanting the prayer or the mantra. You're not asking the deity to enter this murti, this form, for the purpose of worshipping it with regularity. This is a different thing than invoking a deity through mantra. Because you can invoke the deity through mantra or not. But if you say, for example, if you proclaim a vow, and you say to the deity, I'm going to do this, I don't know, 108 mantras on a daily basis for 30 days, and then you don't do it, that's going to weaken your resolve. There may be not a negative reaction, but it's going to weaken your resolve, and you're probably not going to get what you're trying to get. So, there are many, many wonderful stories of the deity entering these forms, of God entering these deity forms, and things happen.
Do they have to stay in the same position then if they enter, or can you take them with you, say?
They have small ones that are portable, and you can take them in all. They take them on procession. Mm-hmm. So, and they might do it on certain holy days. And some people have traveling deities they take with them.
Okay, so you could actually invoke them, could you, if you were using them like that?
Or yeah, you can. Those it can be done. But the big ones that are installed in temples,
once you install them, you can't move them.
Nor can you
be in a particular direction.
Okay, so they have to stay where they are.
Yeah.
And you can't stop worshiping them. Mm-hmm. Because you can't invite God and then ignore Him. So they go on for hundreds of years. In India, there are temples that hundreds, even thousands of years, they've been worshiping the same deity.
Yeah.
And they don't stop.
If you don't do it at home, then you would do it in a temple. People go on holidays, or you might...
Yeah, no, not at home. It's not practical.
Yeah, you might move house. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's not practical at home. We're talking mostly about a temple. Yeah. We've been to them.
Kali ones.
No, we haven't been to the Kali ones.
When you come back, you have to worship them again. And the place doesn't change. Mm-hmm. It has to be in a certain corner in the house. Even in the temples, the big statues would remain there, but the ones which are brought on the procession during the holy days, they are the smaller ones.
Mm-hmm.
The big statue isn't moved out from the temple at all. So the smaller one would be carried out and it would be brought back after the procession.
Mm-hmm. She's mini me.
Yeah, it's a portable version.
And would that be worshipped then back in the temple again with the big one then?
Yeah, then he would be placed on the altar at the feet of the big one typically. Yeah. And he's worshipped every day, same. Yeah. You know, it's like anything you do over and over and over again, it gathers energy. It gathers the Shakti. Because you keep investing it with energy.
Even before they when you follow Stapati Ved with the Vasu for the Shilpa,
Shilpa Shastra,
Shilpa Shastra for carving the deity. It can't just be from any piece of stone. It has to be from a piece of stone that when you strike it, it sings. And it can take years just to find the right stone, just to make the one deity.
So that's what I was going to talk to you about, read you a bit of that. This is from the Mayapur Chandrodaya Mandir in Mayapur, West Bengal. I bought some books from the Krishna Temple in London. And they sent this to me. And this is a deity or murti of Nrsingadev. This is a very ferocious aspect of Vishnu as the half man and half lion. He took this particular form to save one of his devotees from whose name is Prahlad. Prahlad's father was a very powerful demon. And he was, I wanted to be the controller of the whole universe. In fact, he was. He was that powerful. But he was creating havoc everywhere. And he happened to give birth to a very, very elevated soul, his son, Prahlad, who was just a boy. And when Hiranyakashipu, that was his father's name, could not get him to give up chanting the names of God, he got real angry with his son and tried to have him killed off. He tried to kill him off in various ways, like having him pushed off a cliff and boiled in oil and all wonderful kinds of things, poisoned and stung by scorpions and you name it. None of it worked because he was too close to God, and Vishnu, God, protected him. So this was the form that Vishnu took to kill Hiranyakashipu, finally put an end to him because of all his offenses. So it's a half man, half lion form, but it's still God. So here at this temple in West Bengal, some they call them dacoits. What do you guys call them here?
Hooligans.
Hooligans. Troublemakers, mischief makers came to the temple. And they stole two deities from the temple. They took a Radharani and they took a Murti of Prabhupada, of the Guru. And they had to get in a big fight with him, a physical fight. People were killed. Yeah, it's true. Does that mean, you know, I'm at this stage now, maybe 20 years ago now. And so they said, oh, okay, and they got one deity back. I don't know what happened to Radha. They never got Radha back. Or she, I'm not sure. They got the Murti of the Guru back. Maybe they didn't put Radha back because she was violated by these other people grabbing her. You know, it's that sort of thing. I'm not sure. I'm speculating on that. Anyway, so they said, what we need to install is a deity of Nrsingadev. Nrsinga, half man, half lion, because, you know, he's the... Ugra. He's the Ugra Murti. He's horrific. To scare off these hooligans, the negative people. So the deity was just stand there. Okay, so that was the plan. So they went back and forth on that, and they did, well, should we do that, or can we do that? And the incident really disturbed the minds of the devotees. Those involved in management were especially concerned to make some permanent solution. Bhaktivinoda had done this too when they had some deities that were attacked. Not Bhaktivinoda, Bhaktisiddhanta. So they installed Nrsingadev. Installed, that's what they say with the deity, they installed it. They invoked the spirit to come into the form. That's called, in English, installed. So they were real mixed on whether they should do that. So they were not so keen to follow so closely in these footsteps, the pujari. The pujari is the person who is worshipping the deity, the priest, but intimately connected with the deity. Every day, wakes the deity up in the morning, bathes the deity, changes the clothes, feeds the deity, cleans the deity area. I mean, you know, this is your caretaker. This is the intimate person. The pujari must be naishtiki brahmachari. He must be celibate from birth. Celibate from birth. No joking around. Not Catholic priest celibate. Real celibate from birth. And the worship of Nrsingadev must be very strict and regulated. Why? Because of this form, this ferocious form, if you don't do it properly, the backlash could be devastating. You're playing with spiritual energy here. This is God in a very horrific form. It's not like he's horrific toward the devotees, but this aspect of God could get angry very quickly. That's why you have him here. He's a protector. Despite such hesitancy, they were enthusiastic to bring Nrsingadev to Mayapur. Mayapur is the town where the deity, where the temple is. So he asked Bhaktisiddhanta Das. Bhaktisiddhanta Das is a friend of Kalindi's and mine. He lives in Vrindavan. He's an architect and an artist. He's absolutely brilliant. I've known him for 30 years. They asked him to draw some sketches. One day, spontaneously, he said, for some reason, that the deity's legs should be bent, ready to jump, ready to leap. He should be looking around ferociously, and his fingers should be curled. You know how you have the Singhasan in yoga? That is Singhasan, the lion pose. You stick the tongue out like this, and you cross the eyes. Yeah. Supposed to scare you. Okay. And flames should be coming from his head. Flames shooting out from around his head. I sketched a deity in this mood, he writes. The devotees liked it. And Pankajungri, that's the guy who is the pujari, the priest, he agreed to worship him. So he must have been lifelong. Never spilled any semen. That's the idea. That's what that means. So he agreed to worship him. Radhapad, a wealthy devotee from Calcutta, offered to sponsor the sculpting and installation of the deity. He offered to pay for it. It seemed that Lord Narsingadev's appearance in Mayapur would be a simple, straightforward affair. Because we all agreed, we had the sketches, right? He gave 130,000 rupees. It was accepted that the deity would be ready for installation in 3 months' time. Just now coming in India. Oh yes, in 3 months we'll have it. And so the saga began. I left for South India, and this devotee is telling the story as Atmatattva. He is a very transcendental guy. Wherever and whenever he's around, just amazing stuff happens. I've seen him tell other stories. This guy is he's an Indian guy. Very elevated soul. This is him speaking. I left for South India to get things organized. By Krishna's grace, I soon found a very famous stapati. Stapati is a sculptor, but also knows vastu. So he knows how to carve the deity. He also knows how to build the temple according to vastu principles, right? Sacred architecture. A stapati not only sculpts deities, he is also expert in temple architecture and engineering. The man was very obliging until I mentioned that the deity we wanted to carve was Ugra Nrisinga, this ferocious form of Nrisingadev. He emphatically refused to make such a deity. No, I will not make this deity for you. I approached many deity sculptors, but the answer was always the same. No, I won't make it. But we'll pay you. No. No money. No. Like this. I had made a number of trips between Mayapur and South India. 6 months had passed. But Nrisingadev had not yet manifested in his deity form. Radhapad, the money guy, was very anxious to see Nrisingadev installed in Mayapur. He asked me to visit the original stapati I had seen and once again plead our case. This time the sculptor was a little bit more congenial and offered to read me a chapter from the Shilpa Shastra. The Shilpa Shastra is the Vedic scripture that describes the architecture and how to carve. In the Vedas deal with excuse me, every subject under the sun. Everything's in there. And that's the source, believe me. You study Sanskrit, you will find it is the source. That deals with the different forms of deities. He read aloud some verses describing Nrsingadev. A series of verses described his flame-like mane. That was part of their drawing. His searching glance and his knees bent with 1 foot forward, ready to jump from the pillar. When I read this, I was amazed. This was exactly what we wanted, how we had sketched it. I showed him the sketch I had done. He was impressed and offered to draw an outline based on the scriptural description, which we could use as a guide for sculpting the deity. He reminded me, though, that he would not carve the form himself. But he was so blown away that they had actually drawn the image according to what was in the scripture. It took him a week to complete the sketch, and it was very impressive. I returned to Mayapur and showed the sketch to the temple authorities. Everyone wanted the same Stapati to carve the deity because he made this magnificent sketch. Once again, I was sent back to South India to try to convince him once again. I went straight to the house of the Stapati. I was feeling very anxious. What could I do but pray to Nrsinga to be merciful and agree to manifest himself in our temple in Sri Mayapur? I had hardly said two sentences when the man very matter-of-factly said, "I will carve your deity." The story of how he came to this decision is interesting, to say the least. The Stapati had approached his guru. His guru's name was Shankaracharya of Kanchipuram. You have been to Kanchipuram, Catherine and Jim. About our request, his guru's immediate reply was, "Don't do it. Your family will be destroyed." This is heavy energy. This is intense energy. He says, "Don't do it. It'll destroy your family." Well, if somebody tells you that, what are you going to do? Well, I don't want my family destroyed, so. But then, after a moment's reflection, he asked, "Who has asked you to carve this deity?" When he heard that it was of the temple from Navadvip, he became very concerned. "They want Ugra Nrsinga? Are they aware of the implications of sculpting and installing Ugra Nrsinga? Do you know how serious this is?" Such deities were carved over 3,000 years ago by very elevated Stapatis. In other words, you had to be a very qualified and highly evolved soul to even mess with this energy, to begin to invite this energy. 3,000 years ago. Has the human race dwindled in the past 3,000 years in terms of our moral compass and et cetera, et cetera? There is a place on the way to Mysore where a very famous, ferocious Ugra Nrsinga is installed. The demon Hiranyakashipu is torn open on his lap, and it's on the altar. Once the standard of worship there was very high. There was an elephant procession and festival every day. But gradually the worship declined. Today that place is like a ghost town. The whole village is deserted. No one can live there peacefully. Is that what they want for their project? The Stapati replied, "They are very insistent. They are constantly coming to talk to me about the deity. Apparently they have some problem with hooligans. handing his guru a sketch of the deity, he said, "This is the deity they want." His guru took the sketch and looked at it knowingly. Ah, yes, this is the Ugra category. He said, but a deity in this particular mood is called Stanu Nrsinga. He doesn't exist on this planet. Even the demigods in the heavenly planets would not worship a form like this, he says. Yes, this deity belongs to the Ugra category. Ugra means ferocious, very angry. There are 9 forms within this category. They are all very fierce. The one they want is Stanu Nrsinga, stepping out of the pillar. No, do not carve this deity, he said. It will not be auspicious for you. I will talk with you about this later. Forget it. A few nights later, the Stapati had a dream. That's always tips the balance. You know, you have the dream, it tips the balance. In the dream, his guru came to him and said, "For them, you can carve the Stanu Nrsinga." The next morning, he received a hand-delivered letter from Kanchipuram. Kanchipuram's famous for? Silks. Silks. Ghosts wearing silks, yeah. The letter was from his guru, the Shankaracharya, and gave some instructions regarding temple renovations. This is their own temple. Then there was a footnote at the bottom. It read, "For them, you can carve the Stanu Nrsinga." The Stapati showed me the letter and said, "I have my guru's blessings. Now I will carve your deity." This guru, shishya, guru, disciple connection in India, we do not really understand it here. We have no idea how it really works. It's extremely important. Here we regard people, oh, that's just a person. In India, it's not like that. In India, a guru is representation of God in human form. And whatever the guru says must be done, must be taken very seriously. Without the guru's mercy, you cannot make spiritual advancement. This is a fact. And you can test out that theory. So that's why it's so important to have the guru's blessing. It's a cultural thing here that we don't understand it. Okay. I gave him, he said, "I'll carve your deity." I was overwhelmed with joy. I gave him an advance payment and asked him how much time it would take to carve the deity. He said the deity would be ready for installation within 6 months. I returned to Mayapur. Great. 6 months. Well, it'll be ready. After 4 peaceful months, I decided to go to South India and purchase the heavy brass paraphernalia required for Nrsingadev worship and then collect the deity. The trip was well organized and trouble-free until I visited the Stapati. I explained to him that all the paraphernalia required for the worship had been purchased and that I had come to collect the deity. He looked at me as if I'd lost my senses and exclaimed, "What deity? I haven't even found the suitable stone yet." I couldn't believe my ears. "But you told me he'd be ready in 6 months," I exclaimed. "I will keep my promise," he said. "6 months after I find the stone, the deity will be ready for installation." His reply was emphatic, but I just couldn't understand or accept the delay. It's funny, here's an Indian guy with an Indian guy. He can't accept the delay. That makes me laugh. You know, it's one thing for a guy like me to not accept the delay, but the Indians know how it works. Okay. In frustration, I challenged him. "There there are big slabs of stone all over South India. What is the problem? He looked at me the way a teacher would view a slow student. And he said very deliberately, I am not making a grinding mortar. I am making a deity. The scriptures tell us that only a stone that has life can be used to make a Vishnu deity. Vishnu is God. When you hit 7 points of the stone slab and each makes the sound mentioned in the scriptures, there's a certain sound, as Kalindi pointed out, then that stone may be suitable. But there is a second test to indicate whether the stone is a living stone. There is a bug that eats granite. It eats from one side of the stone to the other and leaves a complete trail visible behind it through the stone. Then the second test of the living stone has been passed if the bug has eaten through. Good luck in finding that now, eh? So that stone is a living stone and expression can manifest from it. This, think of the standard that they're trying to... First, he's got to find this stone. Now, you can't, you know, it's not a question of just going looking at a quarry. It's a question of making a connection and having that stone be presented to you. I mean, how in the world are you going to find this? You know? That stone is a living stone. Okay, I said, only from such a slab can I carve your Nrsinga. Such stone speaks poetry. All features of a deity sculpted from such a stone will be fully expressive and beautiful. Please be patient. I've been searching sincerely for your 6-foot slab. 6 foot tall. After 2 months, I returned to South India. There had been no developments. I shuttled back and forth from Mayapur to South India every 30 or 40 days. Finally, our stone was found, and the Sthapati became a transformed man. For over a week, he hardly spent any time at home. Hour after hour, day after day, he just sat staring at the slab. He had chalk in hand, but didn't draw anything. He refused to allow his laborers to do anything besides remove the excess stone to make the slab rectangular. The next time I visited him, he had made a sketch on the stone. That was all. I was worried. The Mayapur managers were becoming impatient. Are you sure this deity will be finished in 6 months? I asked in desperation. Don't worry. The work will be done, he replied. I returned to Mayapur only to be sent back to South India to check on some details of the deity. I found the Sthapati carving the form himself with intense care and dedication. At that stage, the stone had gone and the shape had come. The Sthapati had just started on the armlets. Right? He took 2 weeks to carve them. All the features were so refined and delicate. I was very impressed and very happy. It took the Sthapati a little over 12 months to finish the deity. When he completed the work, he didn't immediately inform me, but decided to visit some friends for a few days. As you do. It was the monsoon season, there were few visitors, and I felt it safe to lock up Nrsingadev securely in his thatched shed, said the Sthapati. 2 days later, his neighbors ran to inform him that the thatched shed was on fire.
In the rainy season.
In the rainy season. There was heavy rain and everything was wet, but the coconut tree roof had caught fire. He ran to the scene to find Nrsinga untouched and the shed burned to ashes. Immediately he phoned me, please come and take your deity. He's burning everything. He's made it clear he wants to go now. Enthusiastically, I traveled to South India, hired a truck, and half filled it with sand. I arrived at the Stapati studio thinking this final stage would be relatively simple. I had foolishly forgotten that Lord Narsingadev is a very heavy personality. He weighed 1 ton. After 2 or 3 hours, we managed to lift the deity safely from the shed onto the truck. To travel across the border safely, we also needed police permission, along with signed papers from the Central Sales Tax Department, the Archaeological Director, and the Art Emporium Director in Tamil Nadu. All the officers demanded to see the deity before signing the necessary papers. Once they took darshan, means they had they saw, of Narsinga, they all became very obliging and efficient. We had all the necessary papers at hand within 24 hours, a miracle, given the usual quagmire of bureaucracy found in government offices in India. The trip back to Mayapur was also amazingly trouble-free and peaceful. Our protector was certainly present with us. So, we'll leave it there. But there's stories. Now the deity has been installed. It's been there for, I think, a number of years now, is it? There are some amazing stories of interaction with the deity that people have asked for various things, prayers, favors, blessings, and many things have manifested in the most miraculous manner, and some of them instantly. So this deity is the energy of God has entered the deity clearly. I'll tell you one that I read a little bit earlier. They had 2 red stones in his eyes, and I guess it was very attractive. And then somebody came and he brought yellow stones. He says, well, take out the red ones and put the yellow ones and they'll look quite nice. And so they didn't really want to do that, but because the guy brought them and he came from so far away, okay, he wants us to take out the red and put in his yellow stones that he brought because it's an offering to God. Oh, he put in the yellow stones. So there was a woman that came from Greece. And she had problems with her eyes. She could barely see her sight was going. And she was visiting there for a while. And that one night she had a dream, and Narsinga came to her in the dream and he says, I want my eyes back. Mm-hmm. What? I want my eyes back. Now, she didn't really know what it meant. She didn't live there. So the next morning she goes into the deity room where all the clothes and all the stuff is kept to look after the deity, behind the altar kind of thing, you know. And the priest is in there, and she says, she goes in there, she goes, yeah, how are you doing? Yeah, good. Because she doesn't know the guy, and she doesn't want him to think that she's a nutcase. You know, she says, I had a dream. Oh, yeah. And Narsingadev was in my dream. Yeah. He wants his eyes back. What? He wants his eyes back. The red ones? And the priestess looked at her. Really? He told you that? Yeah, he did. I don't know what it means. I do. Thank you. And the next morning, he had his red eyes back in. They changed the eyes back to the red ones, the original ones. And he was quite pleased with that, apparently. And within 3 days, her sight completely was restored. But there's many, many stories in here. Anyway, I didn't order this book.
It just came.
It came. I ordered other books.
When myself and when I was hit with a lot of trouble in Bray, I said, I'm looking for a picture of Narsingha, and we found one and we did a photocopy of it. And I think I told you, everything, the electricity just went. And we were like, okay, well, I got the picture of Narsingha. But so we'd try and find the switch, put back up the electricity, everything. So yeah, he's very powerful.
Very powerful, yeah. Okay, let's do a short meditation and then we'll call it an evening. Well, you have too much action on the... close your eyes. Breathe. Relax. And let go. Deeply, deeply relax. Breathe and let go. High above, a beautiful beam of radiant pearl-white light comes down, down, all the way down, entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, torso, arms, legs, out the bottom of your feet, and into the earth below. Breathe, relax, and let go. See and feel yourself by means of this light, connected to the heavens above and grounded in the earth below. Breathe, relax, and let go. All right. You enter a beautiful temple. It is all white marble. And the pillars are made out of red coral. And the base of the pillars, the tops and the bottoms, are gold, pure gold. And there is a murti or deity of Narsingha on the altar. You approach. You bow or you pay your obeisances. What problem do you have that you want to solve? What will you ask him to help you with? What problem in your life needs resolution? Ask him now if you have something. Now, what does he say? Once you ask him, what does he tell you? Or how does he converse with you? Continue until you have a resolution and you feel complete in your exchange. When you feel that, now make your offering. What have you brought for him? Did you bring flowers? Did you bring food that you've cooked? Did you bring fruit? What did you bring? Did you bring precious gems? Could be anything. You can afford anything. It's meditation. Make your offering from your heart and thank him from your heart. And bid him farewell. And return. Leave the temple. Please continue until you have completed the meditation and the steps. And then slowly return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace. When you're ready, open your eyes. Does anybody want to share their meditation? You're not required to. I didn't think anybody would, actually. Okay, so thank you for coming. Om Tat Sat. Hare Krishna.